This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Those of you who know me know that I speak quickly, so that might work in our favor today. This is yet another consequence of the lack of cardiologists since Steve got bumped up to do the cardiology talk. You know what rolls downhill, so I'm here to do the what's new and kidney transplant talk. But I'm happy to do it. Is that box going to go away? Oh, great. Okay. So I think it's always what's hot, but Napa's pretty hot. So maybe people are more interested in what's cool, what's new and what's cool about kidney transplants. So we'll just talk about five papers in 2012 so you can do the countdown and know that you're getting closer. This isn't even a paper. This is just actually work that we've just submitted to the American Journal of Transplantation, looking at kidneys from less than 20 kilogram pediatric donor. Should we be doing en bloc or single kidney transplantation? I'm sure many of your patients have had pediatric donor kidneys used for their transplant. And what we tend to do is the smaller the donor, the more we use the en bloc technique, both for technical and nephron dosing reasons, but of course that takes up two kidneys. So there's this tension between wanting to help two people with single kidney transplants versus a single person with two kidney transplants. So that's what we were interested in looking at. So the first thing that I wanted to show you is that these transplants are concentrated in a small number of centers. And what this shows on the x-axis is the number of transplants done in a 5.5 year period. And on the y-axis is how many centers are doing them. In the box, you can see about 42% of transplant centers in the country don't do any transplants using kidneys from less than 20 kilogram pediatric donors. And you can see that 17% or 44 do only 1 to 2 transplants in a 5.5 year period. And therefore, you can see that this is a pretty highly concentrated activity. For the future slides, I just wanted to tell you that a center that does more than 5 in the 5.5 year period, so that's 36 plus 36, those are going to be considered high volume centers, and those who do 5 or less are going to be considered low volume centers, because we should take a look at outcomes relative to center volume. So the first thing is, and this might be intuitive, that is that across the entire weight spectrum, giving somebody two kidneys yields better 1 year graft survival outcomes than giving them a single kidney. I'm limiting it to 1 year graft survival because that's when the technical issues of these challenging transplants come into play. As I think you can imagine, the two kidney option is going to do better in the long run because there's two kidneys involved. So again, this is 1 year survival. Now, if we look at large versus small volume centers, what you can see is that the small volume centers, the two lower curves, have really suboptimal outcomes for both single and en bloc transplants at the lower weight range. On the other hand, if you look at large volume centers, it looks pretty darn good for the entire weight range. And so I think that this slide is trying to tell you that we can all get, as a community, more bang for our kidney buck if these practices continue where more experienced centers are using these kidneys and using their best judgments about when to split the kidneys into en bloc versus single kidney transplants. And so this is the UCSF experience. We've done 116 transplants in 20 years and a few months, so I think we can just round it down to 20 years. And what you can see is our 1 year graft survival is more than 90%. Our 5 year graft survival is about 88% or so. And our 10 year graft survival is about 78-79%. And I think Rio statistics show that for a standard criteria donor kidney transplant, 5 year graft survival is in the mid 70%. So these kidneys are giving us 10 year graft survival of 78 percent or so. So these are outstanding kidneys if we can sustain that early technical graft loss early on. So UCSF is certainly considered a high volume center in terms of using these kidneys, and we're doing well by your patients in doing so. So let's switch gears to DCD versus DBD kidneys. I think this is an interesting paper that came out in The Lancet. It's a UK registry study, basically looking at, so registry, retrospective, this is what happened. This isn't dictating what is going to happen. At all kidney transplants that are primary adult kidney transplants in a 5+ year period, there are about 6,500 transplants, and of those, 1,800 or so were DCD, and 4,100 were brain dead donors. So DCD donors were comparable in age to the DBD donors, but again, because of these large numbers, there were statistical differences, many of which were not really clinically significant. But they tended to be more male, more white, more smokers, died more often of trauma and other causes, and had slightly lower creatinine. In the British units, it was 76 to 78, so it's very, very small difference. DCD recipients were older, more male, less well-matched, less sensitized, and differed somewhat in the etiology of liver disease. Again, this is a retrospective registry study, so it's not surprising that there are some differences in the groups. DCD transplants had shorter cold ischemia time, 14 compared to 16 hours, and a higher proportion of pulsatile perfusion. In England, 24% of the cardiac death donors had pulsatile perfusion, whereas less than 1% of the brain dead donors have pulsatile perfusion. The alternative to pulsatile perfusion is what we do. We put it in a cooler. So what was the take-home messages from this study? First of all, DBD and DCD kidneys have equivalent 3-year graft outcomes stratified by donor age. So the red line is less than 40-year-old donors, the blue line is 40 to 59-year-old donors, and the green line is greater than 60-year-old donors. So this is what we've been, what we know here in the United States. It's evident in the United Kingdom that the mode of death, brain death versus cardiac death, does not affect long-term outcomes. This is the reason that we don't make people sign a special consent form to receive a DCD kidney, because their outcomes are equivalent. The opposite is true in liver transplant, because there is a survival decrement, but there is no survival impact for DCD death compared to brain death. However, DCD kidneys do have higher rates of DGF. There was a slightly higher rate of primary nonfunction, 4% to 3%, statistically significant, again, because of the huge numbers. But DGF occurred in 49% of circulatory death donors and only 24% of brain dead donors. There was really no significant difference in acute rejection. There was a little difference in 12-month GFR, a little difference in some of the other factors. But the key is there is more DGF. The machine perfusion did not improve graft survival, but did reduce DGF with an odds ratio of 0.67. We don't pump kidneys here, so just for your information. The one other fact that came out from the study was that DCD kidneys are more susceptible to long cold ischemia times, greater than 24 hours. I would be hard-pressed to think of any DCD kidney that we've ever used at UCSF which would have a 24-hour cold ischemia time. But suffice it to say that basically you can see that the purple line, which is the greater than 24-hour cold ischemia time, has a significantly inferior outcome compared to the other lines and compared to the brain dead donor. And this is expressed as the fact that there is an interaction between outcome and cold ischemia time for the circulatory death donors. Now we're on to three, so we have three more to go. Deriving a biomarker of acute rejection, Minnie Sarwal was at Stanford, and now she's at California Pacific Medical Center. She's really been leading the charge in terms of deriving a biomarker for acute rejection. So the idea is, as you can imagine, wouldn't it be great if we could diagnose acute rejection with a blood test rather than a kidney poke? And wouldn't it be great if this biomarker might even be able to allow us to assess whether our therapy was working? Maybe the biomarker would be evident earlier than any functional change would be the precipitant of a biopsy. So this is, there's two slides. We don't really have to go through the details, but suffice it to say that it's a very, very rigorous pattern of trying to look for, identify the biomarker first, derive it, then verify it, and then validate it, and then test it. So the key was that she had a total of, I think, 367 paired blood and biopsy samples, so that we know exactly what was going on in the kidney at the same time as when the blood was drawn. So this is the schematic for how this work is done. You first take a subset of the specimens that you have. You run it on three microarray platforms to look for these genes. This is sort of the discovery phase. That discovery phase identified 32 genes which seem to be worthwhile to test further. You then take that into a more validation phase where you take the 32 discovery genes and you take a second set of specimens, a verification specimens, that then let you can allow you to whittle down the number of genes down to a 5-gene set. And this 5-gene set ends up being locked in by the logistic regression model and then separately tested with a separate set of specimens. So these are the 5 genes. 3 of them are actually increased in those who are rejecting, the 3 in the red box, and 2 of them are actually decreased in the patients who are rejecting. And you can see the performance of these 5 genes individually in the single center verification set as well as in the single center validation set. So what are these 5 genes? They actually kind of make biologic sense, which is always reassuring. They're involved in leukocyte trafficking and TMB cell activation. They're expressed by activated monocytes in the peripheral circulation reflecting tissue injury, and these are the 5 genes. So how well do they predict? Let me give you a sense. The red dots are acute rejection specimens. The green dots are stable specimens, basically normal histology, all read by a central pathologist. The x-axis is time after transplant. And what you can see is the gene set defines a threshold, which reflects the probability of acute rejection. Anything above the dotted line is classified as rejection. Anything below the dotted line is classified as not rejection. So you can see that there are 3 red dot classifications down at the bottom and 6 green dot classifications up at the top with really good overall accuracy. And you can see that the area under the curve is extremely high, 0.955. You can argue that this probably is as good as a biopsy because we all know biopsies are also subject to sampling error. They also looked at the acute rejection specimens along with 72 biopsies that were neither rejection by BAMF nor normal. And the diagnoses of these other specimens included chronic allograft nephropathy, CNI toxicity, borderline acute rejection, and other BK virus and just other stuff. And what they showed, first of all, interestingly, is if you focus on the pink dots, which are the borderline acute rejection, 8 of the 12 are classified as rejection, and 4 are classified as non-rejection. And that's reassuring, because probably some of those people may be on their way to full-blown rejection, and they dominate that upper part of the prediction graph. And you can also see that, again, the AUC for distinguishing acute rejection against all of these other four Motley diagnoses was really quite high. Finally, this is stuff that Minnie has sent to us kindly, which is also under review. They've taken 126 blood samples from heart allograft recipients, which are also biopsy matched. And basically, the same genes seem to be able to identify heart transplant recipients who are undergoing rejection. So what you can see is that the asterisks identify the misclassified samples, which are relatively few and far between. And so they have a manuscript that's under review reporting these findings, and they have a second manuscript that looks at that the fact that this solid organ rejection test, or SORT, appears to be a common immune module for cellular and humoral graft rejection in all solid organ transplants, because they're also looking at lung and intestinal rejection. So I think this is stuff that may really be able to help us down the road in terms of a non-invasive biomarker of rejection. Okay, skin cancer. This is the molecule sirolimus on the left, and this is the classic squamous cell cancer on the right. And so in the New England Journal in 2012, there was this article, Sirolimus and Secondary Skin Cancer Prevention in Kidney Transplantation. So this is a secondary prevention study. So these 129 patients all had a skin cancer. They're all post-transplant, post-kidney transplant patients. They were then randomized to get either sirolimus or CNI continuation. And basically what you can see is the concentration or a diagram as to the patients who were followed. And what did this trial show? Well, first of all, you can see that in the sirolimus bar is up at the top, and this continued CNI bar is at the bottom. And the y-axis is the probability of freedom from a second or a subsequent skin cancer. So clearly, sirolimus had a statistically significant impact on preventing the next skin cancer. The ratio also of squamous to basal cell dropped, because one of the unusual factors about post-transplant skin cancer is that there's this tremendous predominance of squamous cell, and that seemed to be modulated also by the sirolimus therapy. But the caveat is all sirolimus patients had one or more adverse events related to the study drug. 23% had to stop the study drug in 2.5 months, and there were bad events associated with a quick conversion from the CNI to the sirolimus. So I think the only thing I would say about this is there is another drug that is approved for prevention of rejection in kidney transplantation in the same class called everolimus. It's a BID dosing drug, whereas sirolimus is a Q-day dosing drug. Therefore, it has a much shorter half-life. And I think it would be an interesting question as to whether the everolimus might actually be better tolerated, which is what I think we're observing in both the kidney and the liver transplant population. And one more slide on this is that this actually, the sirolimus worked incredibly well. As you can see, it was perfect for people who had a single squamous cell carcinoma, but it worked less well and actually did not meet statistical significance if people entered the trial with more than one squamous cell carcinoma in their history. Although I think there's still an effect, but I'm sure the numbers, this is becoming a numbers game. So finally, I think I'm going to close this with the perennial question, should we be doing transplant nephrectomies or should we not? So I think when a transplant fails, we're all in this room too familiar with all the sequelae of the failed transplant. Presumably there's some sort of rejection process, although one could think that the kidney's just senescent and wore out. Dialysis has to start. People become quite anemic. They may get transfusions. We slow or stop or wean their immunosuppression. The weaning and stopping of immunosuppression may precipitate acute rejection, and then what do you have? Should we be doing the transplant nephrectomy? I think one of the biggest concerns is, does transplant nephrectomy and or all of these other intervening events contribute to allosensitization, the development of alloantibodies that might hinder the next transplant? So that's really, I think, the key factor. In addition, there's also the potential of complications related to the transplant nephrectomy, which might include bleeding, more transfusions, vascular injury, infection, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we all suspected that perhaps transplant nephrectomy would increase allosensitization, because having the kidney there might provide a sink. It might soak up the alloantibodies that are being produced by the immune system. On the other hand, I think there's also suspicion that just stopping or slowing the immunosuppression or reducing the immunosuppression may precipitate alloantibody development. And I think this was shown in after failed islet transplant, when 98% who received 191 islet transfusions, islet infusions, if you look at people who were on immunosuppression versus off immunosuppression, you can see that there was a tremendous increase in the median and in class 1 and class 2 sensitization with stopping immunosuppression after islet transplantation. So there was a very good study that was published in CJSN in 2012. They looked at 95 patients, all of whom had graft loss. And they ended up stopping all immunosuppression within 6 months of starting dialysis. 21 of those patients did not have a transplant nephrectomy, and 74 of them did. But they did not include those who had a very, very early transplant nephrectomy within 3 months of transplantation. Now, they had some sort of protocol at this center where they just took out kidneys systematically. So that's the 17 systematic versus the 31 indicated transplant nephrectomies, presumably because of pain, graft swelling, hematuria, and the usual symptoms. So in total, there were 48 people who had nephrectomies and 21 people who did not. And those will be the subject of the final slides. So what you can see is with a class 1 graft on the left and a class 2 graft on the right, you can see that the prevalence of alloantibodies was quite low at the time of graft loss, the very low bars in each graft. However, at last follow-up, you can see that there was a substantial increase in alloantibodies. And the dark bars, the patients who got the transplant nephrectomy, had much more alloantibodies, or many more of those patients had alloantibodies than the shaded bar, those people who maintained their graft. Now, you might ask, well, when do these alloantibodies show up? And so they have a longitudinal data. And so, again, if you look from the left, it is a graft loss. And the difference between the top and the bottom, again, is just class 1 and class 2, I believe. So suffice it to say that, again, the lower bars on the left are at the time of graft loss. And at the second set of bars is when the graft nephrectomy happened. So there is some increase associated with discontinuing the immunosuppression medications. That's the delta from the first set of bars to the second set of bars. But what's really interesting is that at the time of graft nephrectomy, you can see the alloantibody frequency. Within 5 days after removing the kidney, you can see there's a substantial increase in the prevalence of alloantibodies. So this data, the kinetics of the appearance of alloantibodies suggests that the kidney may indeed have been absorbing alloantibodies such that they were not detectable in the peripheral circulation because of this relatively rapid increase within 5 days of the transplant nephrectomy. And then you can see basically it's 3 months post-graft nephrectomy and additional time pass, and the alloantibodies plateau. So I think that that's all I have to say. It's hard to sum up five different papers in five different areas. I hope that this is of some interest, and there'll hopefully be more exciting, hot and cold new things in transplantation to tell you about next year. Yes, because basically you can see that the majority of patients become sensitized. And if you're sensitized, and these are donor-specific alloantibodies, then it's going to be much, much more difficult to find a matching or suitable second donor. Well, I think we don't know the answer to that. Obviously, it's hard to want to continue immunosuppression over time to maintain something that's not working in the hopes that then you improve chances for the next transplant, because who knows when the next transplant is going to be. Therefore, I'm not sure that this is strong evidence to continue immunosuppression. On the other hand, I think we don't want to be too aggressive in making the decision to remove transplanted kidneys if they were indeed to act up. So I think there needs to be a balanced approach.
Can I ask a question? How about giving these patients rituximab if you plan to do a transplant nephrectomy?
Some drug company might have planted that great idea, but I don't think we could really justify that either. I mean, I think lowering immunosuppression definitely results in the emergence of donor-specific antibodies. You know, my whole life, research-wise, is to take people, liver transplant recipients, off of immunosuppression. And we see that people, as you lower their immunosuppression, the alloantibodies emerge. But I think the key point here is it's clear because there's so many things going on all at the same time, the transfusions, the alloantibodies, changing the immunosuppression. Clearly, the nephrectomy has a direct impact on the alloantibodies. That's what's nice about this study.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.